Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
Tonight we are beginning the book of Habakkuk, or Habakkuk, depending on how you would prefer to pronounce it. I'm going to say Habakkuk all the way through, so just get used to that. The book of Habakkuk is one of those books that you can't possibly understand, you can't really comprehend it, without a real thorough understanding of God's sovereignty. If you have a God who is not in charge, if you have a God who is waiting around to find out what people are going to do and then responds accordingly, you can't fit him into the book of Habakkuk, because the things that God says and the things that God does run so counterintuitive to natural human thinking that you just have to admit, well, that's because he's God and I'm not. That's because he's God and he's sovereign. That's because he's God. His ways are not like ours. His thoughts are not like ours. And as high as the heavens are above the earth, so are his thoughts and his ways above ours. And that comes screaming through in the book of Habakkuk. And in fact, it is a real good journey, though it's only three chapters, it is a good journey from questioning and doubt to faith. Now, this is one of the books where I got my definition of faith. I've told you for years that my favorite definition of faith is to count the word of God as more true than your circumstances. And that's what Habakkuk is going to come to, because his circumstances are certainly going to be terrible, horrific. Jerusalem is about to fall to Babylon, and God says so, and Habakkuk can see it coming. And yet in the end, he ends up saying, but I'm going to trust God, despite how it gets. Now, unlike the other prophets that we have been looking at for our guest this evening, we have been going through the prophets one by one. We're working through the minor prophets at this point. And the difference between Habakkuk and all other prophets is that the job of a prophet is to speak for God to the people. The prophet hears from God, carries God's message to the people. Habakkuk does not do that. Instead, what he records for us is a discussion that he has with God about the people, and not just the people of Israel, but the people, the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, who are going to attack Israel. So it's very different than most of the other prophetic books. In most Old Testament prophetic books, what you see is prophets proclaiming divine judgment. But Habakkuk is actually asking God, where's the judgment? Bring the judgment. He's actually pleading with God for judgment. And the book of Habakkuk, more than anything, is a lament. It's him laying out in very poetic fashion, in a wonderful use of language, he is laying out the state of the people and then laying out the judgment that God is going to bring on those people and learning to accept the sovereignty of God's judgment. In other words, Habakkuk is a theodicy. Do you know the word theodicy? It is a combination of two Greek words, theos, which means God, dike, which means justice. In fact, the Greeks actually have a goddess who is the personification of this idea of justice and moral order or fair judgment. You'll see her sometimes depicted in art, in drawings or in statues, as holding scales as a symbol of proper judgment. When you look at American jurisprudence, oftentimes you will see DK holding her scales, but we in America like the notion that justice is blind, so she's also wearing a blindfold while she's holding what we all know as the scales of justice. There are a lot of Greek words that are drawn from that idea of DK, that idea of justice. For instance, when you read about justification, you're looking at the word dikaiosis. When you read about to justify, the verb that God is going to justify someone, it's dikaiouo. And then, of course, there's dikaiosune, which is one of the early Greek words that I learned way back when, back in California, which is translated righteousness all the way through the Bible. So whenever you see words in the New Testament that talk about justice, justification, righteousness, they all have that DK root to them. So when you put the word theos together with DK, it is basically an argument, a philosophical or theological defense of the idea of God's holiness and there being the amount of corruption that there is in his creation. And people have argued about that for years and years. Atheists will say to you, well, if your God is so holy, so righteous, so all-powerful, then why do all these bad things happen on earth? Doesn't he have either the ability to stop it? Or if he does have the ability, doesn't he care? And so the response to that, the defense that is explaining what God is like and why there is so much sin and depravity in the world, despite the fact that there is a holy and righteous God, that is called a theodicy. So use it in a sentence later, impress your friends. Now, the question that Habakkuk is going to confront, the very beginning of the very first chapter, he is saying to God, everywhere I look, among the Jews, among Jerusalem, among my people, everywhere I look, all I see is unrighteousness. All I see is sin and depravity, and you're not doing anything about it. They have neglected your law. Your righteous law, where you laid it out and told them how to act, how to be, they're ignoring all of that. And so what are you going to do about this, God? You are a holy, righteous God, and your people are completely corrupt. So how are you going to resolve this? And God's answer, I think, is pretty much the last thing he expected to hear, pretty much the last thing that Habakkuk could conceive of. Because God's answer is, I know how immoral the people are. I know how unrighteous they are. And at this very moment, I'm preparing the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, and I'm going to bring them down on my people to judge my people and correct my people. And Habakkuk goes, okay, wait. He doesn't use those exact words. Okay, wait. You mean you're going to punish your people by putting them in bondage to even worse people? So your resolution for the sin problem is to go find even worse sinners and use them to punish your people who are sinful? How does that work? So you can see Habakkuk's marvel at God's response and that he just can't comprehend it. How is that a suitable answer? And of course, then as we get into chapter 3, as God starts really laying out his case, what we're going to see is that God basically says, I'm God, and I will judge everybody. I will judge all evil. And Habakkuk ends up saying, you're right, you're God. My faith is in you. In fact, one of the most well-known phrases in the New Testament, the just shall live by faith, comes right from the book of Habakkuk. because Habakkuk comes to the determination that though the world may be corrupt and sinful and waiting for the judgment of God, those people who belong to God, those people who are decay, those people who are justified, are the people who will live in their confidence in God, regardless of what happens, regardless of what it looks like, regardless of our comprehension. I'm going to wait and see how God does what God does. So that's kind of the big overview of the theology that we're going to be drawing from the book of Habakkuk. Now, as far as Habakkuk himself, we don't know a whole lot. We can draw a couple of inferences from what we actually read. Most scholars trace the name Habakkuk to one who folds his hands or one who embraces. And then they'll argue, because theologians argue about everything, they argue about what that means. Is that Habakkuk embracing the people of Israel? Is that God embracing Habakkuk? What's the point? What we know for sure is his name just simply means to either fold one's hands or to embrace. So Habakkuk is specifically referred to in the very first sentence as a prophet. And then his writing style is more similar to the literary style of the Psalms or the wisdom books. But there is this really interesting clue in the very last verse of the book. The concluding note says, "For the director of music on my stringed instruments." That's Habakkuk 3:19, the very last verse of the book. So that suggests that Habakkuk may have been a musician, and since the musicians that could work in the temple all had to be from the tribe of Levi, we assume that he was Levitical in some way, from the descendants of Levi, and that he was a musician somewhere in the temple. That's as much as we know. He's an officially ordained prophet. We read that. He's then quoted in the New Testament, giving attestation to the validity of his prophetic office, and that he took part in temple liturgical singing. So he's well-educated. We know that by his writing. He's sensitive because he's sensitive to the sins of the people and to the responses that God gives him. And in his literary style, he was as much of a poet as he was a prophet. Now, in terms of when this was written, the reference to the Babylonians or the Chaldeans that I already mentioned, we're going to see that in the sixth verse of the first chapter, that places the book somewhere in the 7th century BC. Don't get confused about the phrase 7th century. That would be the 600s BC. Around the time of the Battle of Carchemish, which is 605 BC, that's when Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar II actually defeated the Egyptians after he had conquered the Assyrian forces, which is exactly what Nahum talked about and that we read last week. That battle took place near the Euphrates River. And so really, Habakkuk is writing during the last days of what would have been the kingdom of Judah and the reign of Jehoiakim, who reigned from 609 to 598 BC and was the last king of Judah as Babylon conquered. So let's start reading. The oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw, that word translated oracle in the NASB is better translated the burden. It means the heavy lift. As we're going to see in the book, God actually tells him to write this down so that he can then tell the people what God is intending to do. And it's heavy. It's a big lift. So the burden which Habakkuk the prophet saw. Here's his first question. How long, O Yahweh, will I call for help and you will not hear? Now, this calling for help, we're going to get a better idea what that is as we continue reading. He is calling out to God saying, "Where are you? All I see is depravity. All I see is law-breaking. All I see is sin. How is it that you are not responding? After all, these are your people, and you aren't doing anything about their corruption. And so I, as a prophet, as a representative of you, keep crying out to you for help. Do something about this situation, and yet you do nothing. Later he's going to say, you're silent. How long, O Yahweh, will I call for help, and you will not hear? I cry out to you, violence. In other words, see, look at it. There's violence everywhere you look. I cry out to you, violence, and yet you do not save. Now, don't think of save there in terms of eternal salvation. In the Old Testament, oftentimes when you see the word save or the idea of salvation, it means to preserve Israel from their enemies, particularly to keep them in their land. And so here he is saying, your people Israel are sinning against you, and in your law you said that for them to remain in the land, they have to remain constant to your law. And they are breaking your law constantly, and we know what the punishment's going to be. That goes all the way back to the original blueprint. The original claim from God is, when you go into the land of milk and honey, and when you start intermarrying with the surrounding nations, and when you start chasing after their gods, I'm going to drive you back out of your land. And so that's what Habakkuk is expecting. Any time now, God is going to punish these people and drive us out of the land that you gave us in perpetuity. So then preserve us, save us, keep us in our land. Don't let us go our own way. I cry out violence, and yet you do not save. Why do you make me see iniquity? In other words, everywhere I look, everywhere I see your people, they're sinning against you. And that's all I see. And why do you allow that to still be the way that our people are acting? Why aren't you preserving them? Why aren't you changing them? Why aren't you helping them? Why do you make me see iniquity everywhere and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contention arises. Everybody's fighting with everybody. There's constant friction. There isn't that brotherhood, that taking care of neighbors that your law would require. And everywhere I look, I see this violence. I see this destruction. I see this strife going on. I see contention between people, and I see nothing but sin and iniquity, and therefore the law is ignored. And justice, there's that justice idea, justice is never upheld. So much of the law, we've seen it as we've been looking through the various prophets and as we went through the Pentateuch, so much of the law has to do with the idea of fair weights and measures, fair balances, fair judges, correct and just and legal and fair judgment between people. But when the law is ignored, that kind of justice is never upheld. For the wicked surround the righteous, and therefore justice he's asking for, that justice that is required of the people by the law, that justice comes out twisted, mangled, perverted. Does that sound familiar, by the way? That's the way the world has always worked, and that is also what is happening even to this very moment in the world. There is no genuine justice. Instead, there is this perversion of justice. And that was happening back in Habakkuk's time. The wicked surround the righteous, and therefore justice comes out perverted. Then starting at verse 5, God gives his first response in this conversation. And God says, look among the nations because Habakkuk has been talking about the Jews in Jerusalem. So God says, look at the goyim, look at the nations, look at the Gentiles. It's not just your people. Look among the nations. Watch, observe, pay attention, and be astonished and wonder at it. God knows that what he's about to say to Habakkuk, if I can use a modern colloquialism, is going to blow Habakkuk's mind, that he's just not going to be able to comprehend it. And God knows that, because he knows that we are just dust. And he knows that we have very limited brains and imagination. And so he says, I'm going to tell you something that is going to astonish you. You're going to wonder at it because I am doing something in your days. That's one of the clues that it's coming right up. I am doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told. If someone else came to you, some other prophet came to you and said, I heard from God and here's what he's planning to do. You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe that prophet. And yet God says, I'm about to do something that's going to astonish you. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans. Really important concept here. I said at the beginning, in the introduction of this book, that you can't comprehend the book of Habakkuk unless you understand the sovereignty of God. That even though, as we've been looking at when we were looking in Nahum and the battles of the gods, even though Yahweh is the God of Israel, he is the only God who demonstrates that he is the God of everybody, and he conquers all the other gods, and he demonstrates that he's in control of all people. He is the creator God. Here he says that he's the one who's raising up the Chaldeans. Now, as we were reading Nahum last week and finishing that book, Nahum was saying that Assyria was coming to take the northern tribes captive. And Assyria had grown to be the greatest power in the Middle East at that point. And yet Nahum predicted that Nineveh and Assyria were going to fall, which was unthinkable at the time. They were unconquerable. Nineveh was impregnable. There was no way that Nineveh was going to fall. And yet, the prophet goes around saying that's going to happen. Well, how did God do that? By raising up the Babylonians, by raising up the Chaldeans, who then conquer Egypt and who conquer Nineveh, who conquer Assyria, and now they are becoming the most powerful nation in the Middle East, replacing Egypt, replacing Assyria. They are now the power that they had to deal with, that especially Israel had to deal with. And God, the God of the Bible, the creator God, the only real God, says, even they being raised up as a power is my doing. I did that. I'm the one who raises up kings. I'm the one that takes kings down. I'm the one who is in control of my creation. And he demonstrates it here again, and you can see it in his self-assessment, in his understanding of himself, that whatever happens is under his control. There are no accidents in history. There's just a sovereign God moving nations and people around. And here, without explaining it or being all theological about it, he just simply says, I'm raising up the Chaldeans. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people. So they're not the good ones. They're really bad, really evil. And by the way, at this point, the people of Jerusalem are very conscious of the Chaldeans. Remember that the Assyrians got all the way to the gate of Jerusalem. They completely conquered the northern 10 tribes. Israel is very conscious of these world powers, these dominant powers, and that Assyria and Egypt get conquered by the Babylonians. You don't think the Israelites were very aware of the Babylonians? that fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs. They just go out and conquer other people. They just take other territories. They are dreaded and they are feared. Their justice and their authority originate with themselves. In other words, they don't follow anybody's law. They certainly don't follow Yahweh's law. They're not listening to Moses. They are a people who are self-driven, self-willed, and yet God says, and I'm in control of them. But in their minds, they think that they're doing all of this according to their own power. They are dreaded and feared. Their justice and authority originates with themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards and keener, more shrewd, more wise than wolves in the evening. Their horsemen come galloping. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swooping down to devour. All of them come for violence. Their horde of faces moves forward. Look at that image, that idea of just this vast number of faces all looking in one direction and moving forward, conquering people. And they collect captives like sand. Nothing to it. They're just collecting people, collecting captives everywhere they go because their army marches with one face forward and they conquer everywhere they go. They mock at kings and rulers are a laughing matter for them. They laugh at every fortress and they heap up rubble to capture it. By the way, that's the way they would work. Oftentimes, they would conquer smaller cities in order to take the rubble to build ramparts to go conquer the walls of the greater cities. God even understands their warfare technique and says, this is what they do. This is how they capture. There's no stopping them. And then they will sweep through like the wind and pass on. They're going to come through so quick. They're going to conquer so completely. It's going to be like the wind blowing through. And they will be held guilty. Okay, so now God finally says, okay, these are terrible people, conquering people. And they don't listen to me. They do whatever they want. They're self-willed. They're violent people. But they will be held guilty. By who? By the sovereign God who's in charge of everybody, who is a God of justice, who is a God of righteousness and holiness, and will not leave the guilty unpunished. But they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God. Now remember, as we were talking in Nahum, and we talked about the wars between the gods and how every group of people had a national god, how even the Assyrians were named after their god, Asher. That's where they got their name as a people group. And so who would be the chief god of the Babylonians? Who would be their national god? Well, it was a god whose name is Marduk. Now, they had other gods, lesser gods, like Nabu or Ishtar. You probably know Ishtar at least once a year. Everybody around here knows Ishtar. Or Enlil, or Enki, or Shamash. These were all other Babylonian gods. But their primary god was Marduk. At one time, Marduk was just a regional god, like all those others that I just named. But as Babylon's imperial success continued to grow. And then there was a major creation epic that was written that included the idea that Marduk was responsible for the creation itself. So the combination of them marching by Marduk and then conquering so that they could raise up their dynasty and the creation epic about Marduk turned Marduk from just a local deity into the very head of the Mesopotamian pantheon. And God here mocks him. because Yahweh is the only real God, the creator God. He knows that the Babylonians look to their god, Marduk. So he says, not only will they be held guilty, but so will their god. They whose strength is their god. Okay, so that's God's opening salvo. He starts with, I'm going to bring the Babylonians down on Jerusalem in order to correct my people in Jerusalem. And Habakkuk hears that and can't process that. So now his argument's going to be, but they're worse. How do you bring down worse people on your people to correct your people? That just doesn't register in Habakkuk's thinking. So he starts by reminding Yahweh who he is. Are you not from everlasting? O Yahweh, my God, my Holy One. He takes the time to remind him, you're the Holy God. You're the righteous God. You're the just God. We will not die. You, O Yahweh, have appointed them to judge. So he understands the purpose that God is going to use Babylon for. And he recognizes that his God, the creator God, the only true God, is not going to abandon his people. He's not going to destroy his people. Several of the prophets we have read so far made that promise. I won't make an utter end of you. And so Habakkuk correctly says, well, we will not die, but you have appointed them for judgment because we are unrighteous. And you, O rock, why would he say that? You rock. When the prophets refer to God as a rock, they're saying, you're our foundation. You're what we firmly stand on. You're the only place we find stability. And you, O rock, have established them, the Babylonians, to correct us. Okay, so he's got the theological principles in place. Your eyes are too pure to approve evil. So now he's wrestling with the theological question that has been around for so very long. Whenever we say that our God is sovereign over all things and everything, or else he's not actually sovereign, if he is in fact God in everything that we can imagine God to be, well, then he is in charge of absolutely everything. But when we say that, the critics of that theology will say, well, then you're saying that God is responsible for sin. You then are making God the author of sin. And there are so many theological arguments out there on the internet. I myself have engaged in the argument in video, and it's up there on YouTube. This argument of, are we saying that God is the author of sin? Or is God able to preserve his holiness despite the fact that there is sin in the world? I won't engage that argument right now outside of saying that's what Habakkuk's dealing with right now. You are holy. Your eyes are too pure to approve evil. And you cannot look on wickedness, the NASB says, with favor. But it's just, you're not even able to look on wickedness. Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? You just got done saying that they are treacherous people, violent people, and yet you raised them up. You gave them the power. Why are you looking favorably on these people? Because after all, I know what you're like. You're pure and you're holy and your eyes can't even look at evil. And yet you're bestowing your favor on the most evil of people. Go figure that one. Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves. In other words, your cure for Israel's sinfulness is to go get a more sinful people to come swallow up your people. How does that make sense? Can you see Habakkuk's dilemma? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Why have you made men like the fish of the sea? This is going to be a little bit of poetic license he's going to take here. He's going to say that the Babylonians are like people who just throw out a net and they catch fish broadly every time. And so many fish that they have to keep emptying their net and then throw it back in. They're just collecting people. They're just fishing for people and grabbing them all. Why have you made men like the fish of the sea? Like creeping things without a ruler over them. The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook and then drag them away with their net, with a dragnet, and gather them together into their fishing nets. And therefore, they, the Chaldeans, who are just swallowing up all the other people groups, therefore they rejoice and they are glad. But what do they do when they rejoice and are glad? Do they give thanks to the Creator God Yahweh who raised them up and gave them that power? No, Habakkuk, to point out how truly evil and sinful they are, says they end up making offerings and worshiping their nets. In other words, they worship the means by which they conquer rather than the God who allowed them to conquer. All Habakkuk is doing is making his case to God that these people don't worship you. These are not good people. They are swallowing up everybody else. They are not just and righteous. And you are. You're pure and good. So why have you made men like the fish of the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook and drag them away with their net and gather them together in their fishing net, their drag nets. And therefore, they rejoice and are glad, and therefore they offer a sacrifice to their net. And they burn incense to their fishing net. Because through those things, through their net, their catch is very large. Their catch is large because of the net, so they give credit to the net. And their food is plentiful. Will they therefore empty their net again and continually slay the nations without sparing? When is this going to stop? How long is this going to go on? You're the God who's in control of everything. Why are you allowing it to be this way? That's chapter one. Chapter two, then, Habakkuk says, I will stand on my guard post like a watcher on the wall. I will station myself on the rampart, and I will keep watch to see what he, Yahweh, will speak to me. And how I may reply when I am reproved. He expects that God is going to correct him and reprove him. And he's thinking about what he's going to say when that happens. But notice that what Habakkuk did, like every prophet, was lay his case out in front of God and then wait. And just wait until God replies. He doesn't move. He doesn't go out and say anything. He waits. He watches. He expects the response. I'll keep a watch to see what he may speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. And then Yahweh answered me and said. Now, the rest of this whole chapter, which we're not going to get through tonight, is basically a dirge, a funeral song to Babylon. God, in his justice, in his actual righteousness, is going to tell Habakkuk, I am going to punish them too. But I'm going to use them in their depravity. You're right. They are worse than my people, but I'm going to use them. I raise them up. I've given them the ability to conquer so that they will punish my people, so that my people will cry out to me, so that we know the Babylonian captivity from Daniel was 70 years. Jeremiah said that that was how long it was going to be. That's what Daniel prayed at the end of it, that God would keep his word and only make it 70 years. And so he says, I am going to punish Babylon. They are going to be conquered, which, by the way, we know the end of the story. Babylon falls to the Medo-Persians as they're busy partying with the implements that they have taken out of the temple. A hand writes on a wall, mene, mene, tekel, upharsin, which means you've been weighed in the balances. There's that balance and justice thing. You've been weighed in the balance and you've been found wanting. So God is just. And he knows what justice is, and he is going to conquer Babylon, but he's going to use Babylon in their wickedness in order to judge his people. And we don't think like that. That's a mighty sovereign God who can come up with a plan like that. So he says to Habakkuk, record this vision and inscribe it on tablets, so that the one who reads it may run. In other words, don't just trust your memory. Write this all down so that when it is published out, the people of Israel will know that the God of Israel is about to punish you, is about to bring Babylon down on you. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, because Yahweh is the God of set times. How frequently have we talked about this? The reason that God could tell Israel that three times a year they had to come up to Jerusalem to keep his feasts. Those feast days are appointed times. He's a God with a calendar. Everything that happens in human history happens at the exact time that he determines it, which is why you keep seeing phraseology like Jesus saying, it's not my time yet. Not my time yet. Then finally he says, it's my time, because everything that God does is happening according to appointed times. So write this down, inscribe it on a tablet, because the vision you're about to see is for the appointed time, and it hastens toward the goal, and it will not fail. Again, what an interesting phrase. Sovereign God does not know and predict the future. He declares the future. He tells you in advance what the future is going to be. And in fact, when he challenges the other gods, he challenges them to do the same thing. Go ahead, declare the future. Oh, and while you're at it, declare the past and explain the meaning of it. Yahweh's the only God who can do that, because all of human history is a declaration of his sovereignty. It's all going to redound to his glory. He is doing everything at its appointed time in order to demonstrate who he is and what kind of God he is. And so the thing that he is saying is coming, he says is coming at an appointed time that he appointed, and then points out it is definitely going to happen, and it's not going to fail. Because he is the sovereign, all-powerful God, so he's the one who can say what's going to happen and then implement his power to make sure that it does happen. That's the kind of God you find in the Bible. For the vision is yet for an appointed time. It hastens toward its goal, and it will not fail. And though it tarries, even though it's not immediately right now, though it tarries, wait for it. It's coming. It's definite. For it will certainly come, and it will not delay. Now, a moment ago, he said, though it tarries, and then he says, it will not delay. That sounds like a bit of a contradiction between the two terms, but this gives you some idea of how the Bible uses that kind of quickly terminology, those kind of time statements. Here he is saying, once it begins, once it happens, once it stops delaying and actually occurs, it's all going to happen quickly. It's going to happen in quick succession. It will not delay. For behold, as the proud, that Hebrew word is the puffed up, the ones who are so full of themselves. How often have I asked this question? It should be tattooed to your brain by now. What's the most often cited sin in the Bible? Pride. Here he is again talking about pride. Behold, as for the proud one, the puffed up one, the full of himself one, his soul, which is his desires, are not right within him, because he's too full of himself. But the righteous one, the justified one, will live by his faith. Now, in this context, God is saying to Habakkuk, trust me. That's how you achieve or demonstrate righteousness. The justified, righteous man who's not puffed up and full of himself has faith in God and knows that God, the sovereign God, knows what he's doing, even when the circumstances are absolutely awful. Well, that's the way that it is also picked up three times in the New Testament. Habakkuk saying that the just shall live by faith is repeated by Paul a couple of times. And if you think that Paul wrote the book of Hebrews, you'd have to say Paul three times. But here's the way that it is positioned in the New Testament. In Romans 1:16, Paul declares, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith." I read it as has faith because the word believe here is pistuo. It's the verb form of pistis, faith. But in the English language, we don't have a word faithing. We don't have a verb form of faith. So we end up with the word believe. But in the Greek, he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek, for in it the righteousness, the dikaiosune of God, the righteousness of God, is revealed from faith to faith as it is written, but the righteous man, the dikaios man, will live by faith. Where'd Paul get that idea? He got it from right here in Habakkuk. And the declaration that despite the circumstances that Habakkuk was in, he nevertheless trusted God because God himself said, this is what righteousness looks like. The puffed up man, the egocentric man, that man, the proud man, the arrogant man, his desires are wrong. He's too full of himself. And he's the one who, like the Babylonians, are going to go off and do whatever they want to do according to their own judgments. They're not going to follow any law or any other opinion than their own. He already described them that way. So they are the embodiment of the puffed up man. But the righteous man, the justified man, is the man who has faith despite the circumstances. Galatians 3:10, for as many as are of the works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone who does not abide by all the things written in the book of the law to perform them. Now that no one is justified by the law before God. And that's evident, Paul says, because the righteous shall live by faith. So Paul, again, understands what Habakkuk is going through and what the lesson of Habakkuk so far is, and that it is trusting God regardless of the circumstances. And then finally, in Hebrews 10, I'll start reading at verse 37, for yet a little while, and then he who is coming will come and will not delay. By the way, you will notice that the writer of Hebrews is following the same sequence that God laid out in Habakkuk. Why? Because God told Habakkuk to write it down so that people later could read it and understand this. And so the writer of Hebrews is quoting from it because he knows what Habakkuk was taught, and he lays it out in the same sequence, which is, behold, he's coming. He won't delay. He's coming. For yet in a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay, but my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. So that same concept of God resisting the proud, but giving grace to the humble, is carried from Habakkuk into the New Testament, quoted three times, and the conclusion, which we're going to see when we reach the end of the book. In fact, since I'm introducing, go to the very end of the book just so we can see how it does wrap up. It does wrap up with the very theology that the New Testament writers conclude. What they actually write about having faith in God, regardless, is exactly what Habakkuk comes to. Habakkuk knows that this trouble is coming. Starting at verse 16 of chapter 3, I heard and my inward parts trembled. At the sound, my lips quivered, and decay enters my bones, and in my place I tremble, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people, the Babylonians, to arise who will invade us. And though, here's the circumstances, though he's about to be conquered, though he's about to see Jerusalem destroyed and the temple burned, he says, and though the fig tree should not blossom and there be no fruit on the vine, though the yield of the olive should fail and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold and there be no cattle in the stalls, even if everything is bad, 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 and more bad, yet I will exult in Yahweh, amen, the God of Israel. I will rejoice in the Elohim, the God of my salvation. Remember what we read at the beginning of chapter 1 was, I keep crying out to you and you don't save. You're not doing anything. And yet he says, but I'll still trust that you are the God of my salvation. It's like Job saying, though he slay me, yet I'll trust him. Because where else are you going to go? The Lord God, that is Adonai Yahweh, is my strength. And he has made my feet like hinds' feet and makes me walk on my high places. He's going to raise me up. Even though it looks like nothing but bad and destruction and warfare, and then he describes a lack of even food. And though there is terrible circumstances on the horizon, nevertheless, I will trust the God of my salvation because he makes me like the kind of deer that can stand on the cliff sides of mountains. He gives me hinds feet. He lifts me up into the high places. So as you leave tonight, I would adjure you to keep in mind that this idea of salvation by grace through faith is not a New Testament thing. It is not a solely Reformation thing. It is as old as the prophets, who have always said that faith in God, regardless of circumstances, is what righteousness truly looks like, which is why we can read that God will take faith, and in the great exchange of God, he gives us righteousness in exchange for our faith. And so this is a very, very consistent theology all the way through the Bible. And whether it's Habakkuk or whether it's Paul in the New Testament, the theology remains the same, which is God is God, you're not. God is sovereign, and sometimes he's going to do things that you don't agree with or that you don't understand or that you don't have comprehension of. But it's really good to know that he's God and he does know and that he does comprehend it and that he is working his plan and that ultimately all things work together for good to those who love God, who are his called according to his purpose. He is doing everything for his glory and for your greater good. And that should give you the confidence to have faith in him and in his word and in his promises, and that he's the God of salvation, regardless of what you're going through. That's right. And that's Habakkuk. Questions?
In the beginning, you said Your definition of faith was believing God.
Believing God's word is more true than your circumstances. Because it is the circumstances of life that will make you start doubting God.
Yes.
Start doubting his salvation and his promises and his care for you. But God has a rich history of putting his people through a whole lot of bad stuff. Doesn't mean he's abandoned them. Right. It means he's the God who can do what he wants with his people. So, anything else?
And we never really, no matter how wise people we become, we never really can understand our circumstances.
Right, yeah. And we don't understand the purpose, just like God saying, you know, tell me history and why it happened. He's the only one who has full comprehension of what's coming and what has already happened and why. Anything else?
Your translation you use is
NASB.
NASB?
Yeah, it's the New American Standard Bible.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's not my translation, but thank you for giving me credit for it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I have many different translations that I use for reference, but for teaching, I have found the NASB to be the most clear, despite how often I adjust it as we go.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. For books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.